Kevin Pollak is a comedian, the host of his own internet chat show, and his acting career includes roles in A Few Good Men, The Usual Suspects, and Casino. On top of that, he was voted one of Comedy Central's 100 greatest stand-ups of all time. And now he's written a book explaining how he's become such a success. It's called How I Slept My Way to the Middle, Secrets and Stories from Stage, Screen, and Interwebs. It's published by Lions Press, and I'm very pleased that it brings Kevin Pollak to our show today. Hello.
Hello, sir. How are you?
Now, you write a lot about how you've developed your impressions, but today they're very different from the ones that impersonators used to do, the Rich Littles, the Cagneys, the Bogarts, the Nixons. Are there certain people who are easier to do than others?
I imagine it's to the individual's wheelhouse as to who's easy and who isn't. And in terms of which impressions are being done, I think it has to do with of the day. I certainly am old enough to have started out in high school impersonating Marlon Brando and Richard Nixon, and have now graduated to Christopher Walken and Jason Statham.
Now, Christopher Walken was on our show just this Tuesday.
Yes.
He was also a guest host on our show once. So what makes him easy to do a good impression?
Well, I actually listened in when he did sit in on the show as a host. And I will say that there were certain rhythms and cadence of how he spoke that made me feel more comfortable. And I was inspired to cook. I wanted to go into the kitchen and make some chicken and pears. Yeah.
He does. He does. He actually did a TV show once in which he did some cooking.
Yeah.
Did you ever see that show?
I've seen the clips on YouTube, yeah.
Now, have you ever done impressions of the people that you're in? For the people you're impersonating, like some other former guests on the show, Albert Brooks, William Shatner, Alan Arkin?
Well, Alan Arkin said, you know, have you noticed I don't stammer as much since you started doing me? I heard the impression. I thought, why is he stammering? I don't do that so much anymore. Huh. The idea is, you know, be respectful to the actual person. Never offer, you know, get in their face with what they, hey, this is what you sound like, you know. And it's rarely a good idea to do them for them.
Because they don't hear it. Well, first of all, you're exaggerating.
Right, of course.
But you have been pretty effective. Didn't you fool Larry King more than a few times?
Well, here's the thing. When it's on the telephone and there's no face attached and it's just a voice, then it can be a little more useful. I did leave a message on Alan Arkin's machine once, as I say in the book. I left this message on his machine. Message to myself. Let's see. I know there was something. Oh, what the hell? Oh, yes. Check on the truck for Tony and get some dog food for Jesse. I think that's it. And then 2 days later, I got this message on my machine. Hi, Kevin, it's Alan. You know what? That's not funny. There was about 9 minutes there. I did not remember leaving that message. So I tell those stories in the book as well. Yeah.
Did you start off doing impressions? Or
I did.
How did you get started in comedy?
I did. I started really first at 10 years old, lip-syncing Bill Cosby's first album. Specifically the No in the Ark routine. So the idea of a little precocious Jewish kid lip-syncing Bill Cosby was enough to win me favor instantly. Of course, it was his material and his voice. So by the time I was 16, I started doing impersonations and then put together an act. And by the time I was 17, 18, I was working in nightclubs.
So did you do the typical thing, the comedy clubs and starting at 3 o'clock in the morning and working your way down to a more reasonable hour?
In my case, I paid dues differently. Although born in San Francisco, a native son, I was raised about an hour south in San Jose. So in the late 70s, there were no comedy clubs there. So I would be when the band took a break, I would be the performer. So when a band takes a break in a bar, the last thing anyone in the bar wants to hear is someone talking. It's the chance finally the music stops for the girls to meet the guys and the guys to buy drinks for the girls. And who's the guy talking? So I think paying those dues and winning those people over, quite frankly, might have served me even better than working out first in a comedy club. So by the time I got to a comedy club, I was a seasoned veteran.
Lenny Bruce had a similar experience working as the guy who talked between the acts in a burlesque house. And, right. And they were saying, get off the stage, yeah. bring out the girls. Yeah. So he said you really had to learn how to be funny.
And fast.
Because you're responding to hecklers?
Hecklers and also just sheer disinterest and indifference, you know. How do you grab their attention when it's the last thing they want to offer?
So when did you decide to move from the Bay Area to Hollywood?
Well, I had risen up. I moved to San Francisco back there when I was about 20 to pursue stand-up full-time. And I didn't stay long. And then I moved to L.A. probably 25, 26 years old. I had risen to the top of the scene in San Francisco. And then it was time to try the bigs, you know.
Mm-hmm. Some people come to New York instead. But did you also have aspirations to become an actor?
Well, the dream was to be in movies, mm-hmm. you know. Because I had been on stage as a comedian, being an actor on stage wasn't as enticing to me. So the movie business was.
Well, your title is How I Slept My Way to the Middle.
Yes, sir.
Obviously meant to be funny. But did you have to sleep your way into... did you have to deal with the casting couch?
You'll have to read the book to find out exactly to what degree I did or did not have to sleep. But the title does actually come from the fact that for years I've been saying, you've heard it's lonely at the top. I'm here to tell you it's fantastic in the middle. You know,
is that where you see yourself, really?
Well, as a character.
Because you have a recognizable name.
As a character actor, though, I assure you, it really is fantastic in the middle. What the middle means is filmmakers offer me work based on my body of work. I haven't had to audition for a film since A Few Good Men, and that was about 63 movies ago. Mm. So that's an amazing achievement for any actor, right, to get offers. And then... the fact that I can get a table in a restaurant based on my face, or I can get acknowledgement and respect from my peers based on my work. But paparazzi's not chasing me down the street, and I can have a life. So that's why I realized finally my place in the sun, in this case, in the middle, was perfect.
Mm-hmm. But you also made the transition from comedy to serious acting.
Right.
Is that... some people have said the most difficult acting is actually comedy. Do you think that's true?
Well, without question it is. It's considerably more subjective. When a moment in a film is sentimental, it's usually a across-the-board reaction. Just about every comedic beat in a film is extremely subjective to the personal you know, taste of humor. So I think that's where that comes from. And then the rest is up to the performer. In my case, I was auditioning for everything when I got to L.A. And in fact, Avalon, Barry Levinson's Baltimore set family mm-hmm. saga, beautiful film, was my first real dramatic film acting. But 3 weeks before that, I auditioned for the TV sitcom Full House and would have killed to be cast in that. So it really was happenstance that I ended up first being seen as a dramatic actor, and then it became careful what you wish. Because as I tell one of the stories in the book, when I was up for consideration for a film, The Whole Nine Yards, starring Bruce Willis and Matthew Perry, had I not known them prior to that, I would not have got the job. Because when they suggested me to the director, Jonathan Lynn, wonderful British director, did My Cousin Vinny and several
others.
He did
Lolita.
There you go. They asked him... you know, to consider me for the part of Yanni Gogolak. And Jonathan said, fellas, you know, I'm a fan. I've seen his work. I've seen A Few Good Men. I've seen Usual Suspects. He's quite diverse. But, you know, this is a comedy. And Bruce thankfully grabbed him and said, he's a comedian, you idiot. Yeah.
My guest is Kevin Pollak. His memoir is called How I Slept My Way to the Middle, Secrets and Stories from Stage, Screen, and Interwebs. And we'll get to the interwebs in a little while. Let's talk a bit about A Few Good Men. That you sure. suggest was your breakthrough. And it allowed you to work with Tom Cruise.
Yes.
Is he as eccentric in real life as he has been in some interviews? And does he insist that everybody in the cast become a Scientologist?
No, and not at all. I do attack a few people in the book for being bad people, in my opinion, in my experience. And then I also, because I don't suffer fools well, but also felt it was appropriate to champion certain people if they've been especially generous and in his case, inspiring. He was open to talk about Scientology if you mentioned it. He never mentioned it. I have great respect for anyone's religious beliefs, whatever they are, not only in keeping with the Constitution, freedom of that choice, but also I myself am not terribly religious. So if someone is, I admire and respect that in them, whatever their beliefs are.
But he did help you get Alexis.
But he did help me get Alexis. Well, the story in the book goes that I used his fame to have a car delivered to the lot. I bought a new car by the GM under the auspices that he would get a chance to meet Tom Cruise. Yes. He's been a great champion and quite inspiring. To treat me as an equal day one, you know, that's one thing to do professionally, but it was so sincere.
And that generally happens, although, as you point out, there are some people who are just difficult.
Yes.
Or can be mean and whatever.
Yeah, and usually there's no reason to mention names, but I do.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Well, because you hope never to work with those people again?
No, because I think people should be responsible for their actions.
Now, your mother caused a little bit of trouble because
should also be responsible for her actions, by the way.
she wanted to meet Jack Nicholson.
Very, very much. Came to visit on the set of A Few Good Men. We were shooting the courtroom scene, specifically a camera angle set up over Nicholson's shoulder, shooting outward of the entire courtroom, myself and Tom and Demi at the legal table, Kevin Bacon at the defense table. So there was no place to hide my mom off camera where she could watch other than Nicholson's other shoulder. So now she's in my eye line. Let's start there, that nightmare. And then between takes, I see her literally hitting on Jack Nicholson. Which was more unnerving than you would even imagine. The fun part came when Nicholson observed how unnerved I was and decided to have fun at my expense. He came over to the table where I was sitting between takes and said, "Hey, Kev, how's it hanging? Listen, I was wondering if you could do me a favor." "Yes." "Was hoping you might be able to get your mom off my ass." "Huh? What am I supposed to do? Am I supposed to take your mom back to my trailer? Is that what you want?" Yeah, that's a memory I don't think I'll ever forget.
You worked on Casino with Martin Scorsese directed Robert De Niro, but also Don Rickles was in that. So now suddenly there are two comics.
Don Rickles had been a hero of mine forever, so just to be near him was exceptional. But then to have him befriend me and watch him make fun of De Niro in front of the crew was maybe as good as it's ever going to get.
Because it brings the star down to the level of everybody else?
Well, yeah, that's what Rickles does, of course. But in the case of the great Robert De Niro, you have to understand, when he walks on the set, every sphincter tightens. You know, he has that effect on people. Rickles was not impressed. So also, in the middle of a take, he would turn on him and say, "Is that the way you're going to do it? Like that?" "No, you got the awards. I'm sure you know what you're doing. Go ahead."
Scorsese must have loved that.
Scorsese was wheezing with laughter, as was De Niro. Joe Pesci, not so much. No, Joe did not appreciate when Rickles pointed out that Joe was so short, he's going to ride him around the set like a Shetland pony. That did not go well.
But you don't do comedy when you're working on a film like that, do you?
I usually don't go after the star, no.
Your first appearance on The Tonight Show was different from most comedians. They are expected to get up, do an act.
Mm.
And after they've killed, they come and they sit with Johnny for a little bit, or sat with Johnny, who I think was one of the great interviewers of all time. Mm. But you insisted on doing it differently?
Well, I grew up watching The Tonight Show starring Johnny Carson and dreamed one day of doing stand-up comedy on the show. By the time I was asked, I'd been in L.A. a couple of years, I was asked by the great gatekeeper, in this case, Jim McCauley, whose job it was to find new comedians to be on the show. And he would, what we called, circle an act because he felt they had to have two appearances ready, because if Johnny loved them, he might say to Jim McCauley, "Bring that kid back right away, would you?" And so he had to make sure we all had two appearances ready. So by the time he asked me, I had seen a smaller handful of comedians appear from the couch doing their act in the guise of a conversation. Albert Brooks, Steve Martin, Don Rickles. And then that became the fantasy. So when I was asked by the gatekeeper, I was young and stupid, and I took a chance, and I said, you may think I'm crazy, but I would like to wait until I have a TV show or a movie so that you can justify bringing me straight to the couch, and then I'll do my impersonations of Peter Falk, who Johnny loved and had on the show often. And I just think I'll have a bigger impact from the couch. And I know there's a protocol. You can't just bring me to the couch. And he looked at me first like I was an alien. And then he said, I can't disagree. And, you know, you're only going to get better. You're not going to get worse. So if you want to wait, he said, do you have a TV show or a movie coming out soon? I said, no. What he didn't know is that I not only didn't have any prospects or auditions, I hadn't got an agent yet. I was just so focused on the perfect way to do my favorite show, and it was that couch. And it took about a year and a half, and a movie I did called Willow was enough for them to justify bringing me out as an actor. I did Peter Falk in the first 30 seconds of the interview. Johnny loved it. I was invited back three times a year until he retired.
I used to love watching him with comics because he acted as a straight man. Yeah. He was not in competition.
That's exactly right.
And he did that for you, too?
Very much so. In fact, one of the best compliments I had from appearing on the show often was when people said, Johnny really likes you. You know, they didn't compliment a certain routine I did or a voice that I did on the show. The best compliment was always, Johnny likes you, you know, because he made that clear.
You have your own talk show, the KPCS, the Kevin Pollak Chat Show on the Internet.
Yes.
What do you try to do there?
I've always been a fan of autobiographies as a reader. So my idea was to try to truly have a conversation and find out about the person's journey, how they got from there to here in long form. I remember watching Dick Cavett would talk to Betty Davis for 90 minutes. So the idea was on the Internet, no censorship, no time restraints. So I average now about 2 hours with every guest. John Landis holds the record of just under 3 hours. He's a talker. But it's Eddie Izzard for 2.5 hours. It's, you know, Kevin Smith for 2.5 hours. It's remarkable. I don't tell the guests we're going to go for 2 hours because they'll tighten up. But it's always delightful when I say, we've been talking for 2 hours. Are you aware of this?
You do have to choose people who can fill the 2 hours.
Well, that's the joy for me, is that I booked the show myself. So I'm predisposed to be fascinated.
And you've also used the British name for a talk show.
Chat show.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
I would not allow them to call this the Leonard Lopez chat show.
No, you
I'm
wouldn't.
Sorry. No.
I thought it was perfectly pretentious and therefore funny.
So how did you even get interested in doing a live streaming web show?
I went to visit a friend, one of these internet mini mogul jerks, in this case, Jason Calacanis, and he had a little studio as part of his company. I walked in and I looked around at the lights and cameras and very unassuming, and I said, without having thought this sentence prior, I said out loud, I think I want to do a Charlie Rose but fun from here. And unfortunately for me, he said, how soon can you start? And April will be 4 years. We've done about 160 of these mostly two-hour interviews.
And your show averages several hundred thousand downloads a month. But how do you promote a show like that?
And sometimes as many as a million downloads. And we're on Hulu now, of course. And it's always interesting when we get a large live audience for the Internet. When Sugar Ray Leonard was on, we had 85,000 people watching live, which was astonishing. I marketed first on Twitter, just announced it on Twitter. No traditional media marketing at all.
I hate it when people ask me who my favorite guests have been. Does it bother you, too?
Yes.
So do you have any favorites?
I can't believe it. As someone who admits that he doesn't like it, to go ahead and proceed.
But to me, almost all the guests were good except the ones that weren't, and that's much easier for me to remember.
Well, I'm a poker player my whole life, and the poker player remembers the hands they lose, not the hands they win. Mm-hmm. So I tend to remember the guests that I did not enjoy more than I do the ones, because I enjoyed all the rest.
What about working with some people? William Shatner, for example, who has a reputation for not being the easiest person to work with.
Mm. Well, I've been impersonating him pretty much my whole life. So we had a bit of a history before we met. And fortunately for me, he was enamored with it.
Mm-hmm.
So
it was complimented. I would think most people are complimented.
If you do it well and you don't truly mock them in an unflattering way, as it turns out. Although I am very concerned about possibly meeting Jason Statham someday because he scares me.
Really?
Well, I started doing him because he says six particular words faster than any human I've ever seen. Those six words being, do you know what I mean? And he says it as, do you mean? And I said, well, I have to continue playing with this voice. And now I like it very much, and he calls me. I'm afraid to get that call at 4 o'clock in the morning. You know what I mean? Yeah. Do you know who this is? Do you know who I am? I'm the bloke's going to rip out your little heart. Do you know what I mean? Yeah.
Sometimes I would think that it's intimidating to share a stage with someone like Steve Martin, for example.
Very much so.
Because you got to be funny with a man who is just so funny.
Yeah. When I started out in San Francisco, I found myself on stage improvising with Robin Williams, and I would think, I don't belong on this stage. You have to find a way to justify your presence.
Now, you've done Lenny Bruce. Is he somebody who was one of your heroes? I mean, you started with Bill Cosby, who is nothing like Lenny Bruce.
Well, at the time, when Bill Cosby's first album came out, you know, when Lenny first came on the scene, he was very similar, appearing on Ed Sullivan and doing very straightforward act and impersonations himself and characters. And so when Steve Martin and James Taylor asked me to participate in the 120th anniversary of Carnegie Hall, it was a big tribute night, and it was Steve's idea that I do a tribute to Lenny Bruce. I hadn't tried to do the impression before that. I learned it for that. Mm-hmm. That event.
There's a lot of film, and there's an awful lot of there are a lot of records.
A lot of records.
And it turns out that he kind of changed comedy, don't you think? So many comics I've seen since, like Albert Brooks, probably wouldn't be doing the kinds of comedy they do if Lenny Bruce hadn't changed the whole concept of what stand-up is.
Yeah, it's changing the vernacular also of humor in the performances. And then you have the conversational, personal experience behind, and not just one-liners and jokes.
Kevin Pollak wasn't kidding when he said he was in, well, you've been in 70 films, including A Few Good Men, The Usual Suspects, Casino, Grumpy Old Men franchise, numerous TV shows. He's written a memoir called How I Slept My Way to the Middle, Secrets and Stories from Stage, Screen, and Interwebs, published by Lions Press. Thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.